Summer camp in Chilliwack?
In Chilliwack, yes. I think that's the only summer camp I attended with the OTC. Because with the end of the war, summer camps continued there.
You mentioned before when we were talking that at a summer camp you had the men's division and sort of an invasion.
Oh, it's at Nanaimo.
Yeah, was that in this period too, after the war?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It must have been two camps. Yes.
Can you tell about that?
Well, I thought it would be interesting to do a simulated landing at Qualicum Beach, so we devised a scheme whereby ACIs would take charge of mortars, 2-inch mortars, and others take charge of the machine guns, and we were firing to the flank and smoke mortars into the face of the oncoming people. It was just to give them atmosphere, and it was part of a general scheme. The GOC at the time, I think, turned a little pale when he showed up and saw this exercise going on.
How did it go? Did you make a beachhead?
Yes. We didn't do a landing because we didn't have the barges, but we put people on a beachhead situation, had them move in against the fire and then deploy in certain exercises. In those days, Qualicum was pretty well deserted.
All right. What gave you the inspiration to have this simulated landing?
Well, it's a sort of a typical maneuver. Sort of thing that the person might expect to do at some point, and certainly with the Far Eastern thing going on, it was a typical Pacific maneuver that had to be accomplished.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah. The war ended in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how you felt
when
after 6 years of war?
Well, I think everybody was relieved and pleased. My personal situation was a little untypical, perhaps. I'd received a low medical category as a result of being knocked about in Italy, and I really began to lose interest in the whole thing. For example, there was an order that came around that people might volunteer for the Far East. I thought it was rather a stupid thing, having volunteered for the war, that you should be asked to volunteer for the Far East. If I'd been directed, I wouldn't have thought anything about it, but the notion of volunteering again, and put in mind the possibility that it was an option. But so far as I was concerned, I had no expectation of active service unless they altered the physical categories severely, so I thought I'd get back to the business of qualification. And I had saved sufficient money. I had intended really to go to Osgoode Hall, but then I learned that my faculty of law was being organized at the University of British Columbia. And since I intended to practice here, I thought I might just as well get in on that if I could.
I see. You never considered a career in the Army at this time then?
Not seriously. I'd been nominated for a staff course, which I was then taking. Which might have led to a permanent appointment, but I really didn't have in mind that as a desirable goal to be a professional soldier.
Yes. How would you account for your continued interest in the COTC then?
Oh, it was just a matter of, I think, just a matter of general civic responsibility. I thought that the post-war period wasn't all that settled. It was really quite uncertain what the Russians intended. And I didn't think there was very much point having won a war to disband and be afraid of somebody else who might have different ideas. So I suppose by this point I had felt that the military had an ongoing function.
I see. This was quite different than after World War I. The sentiments were decidedly against any continuation of the military.
Yes. Well, of course, with the cessation of World War I, there was no other subsequent danger perceived. The intention of the Soviet was really quite unclear.
Yeah.
Any clarity that attended was menacing. The Berlin blockade things of that sort were coming about. The Soviets were really quite aggressive.
Yes. Would you say that student opposition, or possibly faculty opposition at this time, was negligible then too, in view of the uncertain international climate?
Well, I don't think I could generalize about anybody's attitude, but the OTC was pretty generally accepted. In fact, in the years I commanded the OTC, I think UBC proportionately had more people involved than any other OTC unit in Canada, and more on active service or into the reserve than any other unit in Canada. Then the Korean thing, of course, came along, and we had cadets who had qualified, who were involved in the Korean exercise. And all of this in that day and time was thought to be a perfectly normal and commendable thing to be involved in.
Yes.
I'm not sure that those are the attitudes today, but in that immediate post-war period, everybody was still very much of the mind that the military had a place. A certain amount of international law and order arose from the fact of being prepared.
I see.
As a matter of fact, I think that point of view continued until the Americans got sadly involved in Vietnam. I think much of the current disillusion with military activity is a reflection on the American involvement in Vietnam. I think that's true in North America anyway. The British don't seem to be so adversely affected. They have a high degree of recruitment and high morale in their units are intact.
Yes. How about the attitude towards the United Nations? Did you see this as possibly not being as effective in keeping international peace?
I think the UN had a very good reception as it began and for a number of years afterward, but I think it became increasingly seen as an ineffective organization. The notion of an international peacekeeping force, which is really implicit in UN sanction, really never emerged. It probably cannot be expected to emerge, I don't know about. It's just that the realities of the Cold War put the hopes attached to the UN really into the shade.
In January 1946, General Cuellar visited campus, and a meeting was held with officers and veterans of the contingent. The commanding officer's reports, I think Mr. Shrum would be the author of the report at this point, said that there were informal discussions regarding future officer training.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any recollection of this meeting? Did you attend?
I must have attended. Mm-hmm. There were quite a number of meetings in those days. In fact, we were going back to infantry meetings in Ottawa and things of that sort during this period. I don't think it was at this meeting, but at a subsequent one in Ottawa where General Cuellar said, in effect, we were manning our own Roman wall, and that was the mentality of the period. And military training was geared to the accepted the menace which was involved in Eastern Europe. The Russian thing was viewed as a large, undefinable, but a valid threat.
What do you think was the main sort of changes in the, well, perhaps before we get to that, you became commanding officer in February 1946, succeeding Colonel Shrum. Can you describe the steps how you became CO?
Well, I suppose at one point Gordon Shrum asked me if I would take over from him. I think that's about how I came along. I thought that would be an interesting thing to try because I was an undergraduate on the campus at the same time. I was going to be there anyway.
You're quite a young man. Did you have any apprehensions about it?
Not really. Not really. I remember thinking that the secret to success of the exercise was not to venture beyond the certain knowledge. And I suppose I adopted that as a general course of conduct. And I don't hesitate to draw on the knowledge of others unless I've had an opportunity to research a thing. I won't take too many flyers beyond my own certain knowledge. That was a sort of a scheme of dealing.
Can you tell me about some of your recollections of other people in the Corps? Captain Ritterhoff, for example. Do you remember of him?
Yes, he was always a great wit. We used to have lunch in the mess, I suppose, daily. And he was usually in attendance. Very sprightly conversation, yes. Good humor. Given to the classics.
Yeah. Captain Topping?
Topping, yes. Well, he'd been an instructor of mine in economics in part, and he was always fairly dogmatic in his viewpoints. Willing to see another point of view, but usually held his opinions pretty strongly.
You remember Captain Walmsley?
Oh yes, Sherry Walmsley, yes. Very urbane fellow. He was adjutant. I haven't seen him in recent years. In fact, I don't know whether he's still in the city or not. But he was a very careful man, very precise. And he did a good job.
Okay, COTC was reorganized in 1946. There are several important changes. One was, of course, for the first time COTC was given the recognized as a body able to give commissions. Mm-hmm. This wasn't the case before. You had to apply with regular forces. First of all, maybe you can tell me what machinery was set up so that you can commission cadets directly yourself into the services.
Well, it was a machinery which consisted not only of the campus training but qualifying examination. Not certain that I understand the question from there.
How would you, for example, decree that a person is commissioned into a particular reserve unit?
Well, he would have to apply and be received by that unit. And there would be recognition of his COTC qualification. Precisely who issued the paper, I guess I've forgotten, but it would be on a concurrent a certificate of qualification from the OTC, acceptance by the reserve unit, and the laying on of hands by Army. The commission paper is actually issued out of DND.
How about the syllabus? Were there any notable changes?
No, at that point the syllabus had become pretty well established in terms of the various military manuals, which at that point were completely reflective of wartime experience.
Uh-huh.
You always had a certain amount of discretion as to how the syllabus was given out or applied in instruction. I suppose the fact that we had a small group of relatively experienced people was of some assistance in imparting a sense of realism to the instruction. At that particular point, there was pretty general acceptance of the OTC as a unit, and we had our selection, really, of those who wished to enter. Many would apply, and not all would be received.
Do you think that the Corps is becoming more oriented towards profession rather than training for warfare? Like, was there less emphasis upon drill and regimentation after the war? and more towards technical knowledge.
No, it was essentially a military professional training. In other words, there was no concession to the fact that the country wasn't at war. There's no purpose in making that type of concession. You've got to qualify an officer, you qualify an officer for what he's expected to do. You want to train civilians in something else, you train civilians. If you're training officers, you're training officers.
Yeah, well, one thing I noticed was that in one of the CO reports that training wasn't compulsory. I mean, pardon me, parade wasn't compulsory. Not at first, anyway, not in 46, 47. That changed later.
Well, it might not have been compulsory, but people didn't pray, they went with the unit very well.
Oh. What was your attitude towards that? Did you feel that people really had to turn out for the parades?
Oh, yeah.
Did you initiate any efforts to bring the contingent closer to the reserve units, to the local reserve units?
Yes, there was quite a bit of liaison back and forth. I brought commanding officers and company commanders out to give instruction. And for a number of years, I think the relationship as a result was fairly close. So the reserve unit commanders in those days, too, were freshly returned, and so to a greater or lesser degree, we all knew one another. So it wasn't a matter of any difficulty. They were anxious to be of assistance, and it was a matter of assisting their own officer recruitment from their point of view, and also a matter of our having a wide access to experienced officers for the purpose of giving greater depth to the instruction which was taking place.
And the 1947-48 commanding officer report has a statement which criticized the disparity of pay between COTC officers and those in the regular services. And the reason for this was that because you are now granting commissions, produce qualified cadet, qualified officers, the work you had to do in administration and documenting the officers was as great as any reserve unit.
Yes, it would have been. Is that part of my report at that time?
I that would probably be your.
I suppose it was.
Your statement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I must say I hadn't thought of it from that day to this. But
did you ever resolve it? Rectify it?
I don't think it was resolved. OTC always existed as a kind of a separate effort in the military in Canada. And, the opportunity of resolving it on a local basis, I think, was minimal.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask about the university administration. Were they fully cooperative with the OTC?
Oh, yes, extremely so. Norman McKenzie, who was the president, of course, had been a soldier in the First War, and I think he was a very aware sort of a person in terms of the implications of the Second War. He had considerable connections with the national government. And he was a man of many parts in that sense. So. And he saw the OTC, as I gathered his opinion, as being an important feature of one of the things a person might do at university.
So, in any occasion when you had to consult him or have a meeting with the Committee for Military Affairs, he was always pretty well supportive.
Oh, yes, I would say so. Mm-hmm.
How about Chancellor Hander?
Well, I think his role was less formal, but Hander was also honorary colonel of the Sea Force, so I had no problems in that case. I knew him quite well.
Did you retain your affiliation with the Sea Force yourself?
Still do.
Uh-huh. You belong to their, do they have a legion?
Well, they have an association. I belong to the association. I'm not really very active with it. But I remain a member of the mess all these years. Once the Sea Force, always the Sea Force, you know.
It seems to be one of the most well thought of and I should say, so popular units in Vancouver, the Sea Force.
Yes.
Patricia's.
Well, Patricia's are Victoria outfit. the Seaport is has been very popular, and probably still is. It's in a lesser role than it used to be. But the Seaport were a very professional crowd, albeit reservists for the most part. I think we produced as many senior officers in the Canadian Army as any unit you can think of. And we gave a number of senior officers to other units. Bert Hoffmeister, probably the most senior among them, he was colonel of the regiment when I joined, and he became brigade commander, and then commander of the division, and then commander of the corps, and then he was in charge of the Far East Force. And there were quite a variety of officers, I would think a few dozen, who rose to positions of prominence in the Army hierarchy from our unit. The unit has always been very demanding in its standards, and very successful on that account.
I'd like to go back to when you assumed the commanding officer's position.
Mm-hmm.
And you stated that Colonel Strum asked you to, if you'd assume the command.
Yes.
Now, you still have to be appointed by the committee for the post, don't you?
No, it was a... What committee do you speak
committee
of?
Committee for Military Affairs. Mostly the campus people, president, chancellor, the CEO, and certain faculty members who presided on the committee.
No, I don't think it went that route at all. The record may show it did, but I don't recall that it did.
I know they appointed the previous commanding officer.
Yes.
But
I don't think it worked that way in my case. As a matter of fact, I'm surprisingly vague in my recollection of how it really came about, because I was there all the time on a professional basis, and then came through Army orders, and I took over. I'm sure there was more to it than that, but I was living a rather intense life as a law undergraduate at the same time, so I think probably my mind was as much on law as anything else while all this was going on.
The fact that Colonel Shrum sort of nominated you, though, this probably had a lot of weight with the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other candidates at the time?
I'm not aware that they were.
You mentioned earlier, in our previous discussion, that you attended meetings in Ottawa as the representative of the UBC contingent.
Yes, these were gatherings of officers for various briefings. I think there were two or three.
What kind of briefings? Like, what were they about?
Well, they were background briefings to the general role of the Army at that time. General observations about the situation in Europe and generally what was expected of the OTC from the standpoint of production of officer personnel. In those days, the Army had a fairly clearly defined role, the atomic bomb notwithstanding, and we were proceeding essentially along what would now be regarded as conventional lines in the role of the armed services. Generally speaking, we had a strong position in post-war Europe in what became the NATO organization. And of course, Korea was boiling up. There were lots of alarms and excursions about the Russian situation in Europe, and I say it culminated more or less with the Korean exercise. So that although we were not at war, and peace had
technically
set in, it was considered officially to be somewhat fragile so far as future involvement might be concerned with the Russians.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about NATO, established in 1949. Did your approach to the training of cadets, was it affected by NATO, the fact that you would have to have, there'd have to be Canadian contingent in Europe as part of NATO?
Well, it gave a sense of realism to the whole exercise. We were training essentially for two aspects of service, the reserve units, which would be essentially our primary goal, and secondarily for active service. The Army was in a fairly good state of readiness, and junior officers were in some requirement, especially when Korea began.
Were there very many cadets from the COTC that went to Europe? Were there some, anyway?
Yes. I don't have a number in mind, but my recollection of the period was that we had quite a number go in active service, and quite a large number indeed go into the reserve force. I think our record among the OTCs in Canada in that connection was pretty high. I think the University of Toronto may have been better, but it was larger to start with.
Did you receive any feedback, say letters or comments from officers abroad in the case of Europe, as far as their training went, how it equipped them for their role in Europe?
No, but I would say that they would get their most important training after leaving us. Because of the limited nature of OTC training. It's one thing to train out of a book, and it's another thing to train on weekend exercises, and it's one thing to train in reserve camp situations, but all of this is pretty pale alongside the field training with a unit, whether in the active force or actively engaged force. That's where your real training begins.
Did any of your training envision acting in conjunction with the other allied ground forces in Europe, British and American?
No, it wasn't that far. This is pretty rudimentary professional training.
1950 to 51, 52, this is sort of the height of anti-communist feeling in the United States. McCarthy is morose at this time. And I wonder what sort of repercussions you would have felt Vancouver at UBC in the Corps.
I'm not aware of any particular repercussion. The McCarthy hearings were on, certainly. I think they were viewed essentially with a sense of detachment as something going on rather strangely in the United States.
Do you remember being in South Korea, a rather extreme situation in the United States, say, compared to Canada?
Well, I thought McCarthy was certainly extreme. The role of the Communist Party in those days, of course, was viewed with great suspicion as to its objectives and what it really intended. In many respects, I think Communist activity was linked with active espionage and the suspicion that they were furthering imperialist aims of the Soviet Union. How well founded those impressions were in fact, I was never in a position particularly to say, not with respect to those days anyway. I later had other impressions, but they touched on another role which I had. However, I think the official view was pretty substantial. Remember, there had been the Gozenko expose in Ottawa in the post-war, the revelation that there was an active espionage activity in Canada aimed at deriving information from official quarters clandestinely. The Soviets, either through the Communist Party or otherwise, were thought to be very active, and I think that was close to the truth of the matter. The secrets of the atomic bomb weren't sent by airmail, after all. They were derived by detailed espionage.
You didn't have lectures or things like that in the Corps, though, which kind of warned cadets against.
No, no, there was no particular emphasis on that point.
1949, that's when the Soviets exploded the first atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, seeing the nuclear age coming, did this affect the Corps in any way? Did you see it as being perhaps having a diminished role in military policy?
The presence of the nuclear bomb on both sides, I think, cast into very considerable doubt the role of the armed forces generally, but particularly the Army, because it's one thing to depend on conventional firepower and to cope with it. It's quite another thing to be confronted with atomic warfare and its aftermath. And so I think a very considerable confusion and demoralization arose at all levels in the armed forces in not seeing clearly what they might be called upon to do for the future. And that was particularly evident in the reserve forces, apart from OTC, where for a time the reserve forces were cast in an atomic role, which really made them akin to preservers of civilian law and order and kind of a cleanup squad for whatever order might be introduced in the aftermath of an atomic holocaust. And I'm not sure that the services have entirely recovered their sense of purpose as a result of the atomic bomb. I think what sense of purpose now exists is largely in spite of, not because of, the atomic bomb. I think probably the present opinion is that it's just too horrible to be employed, and therefore conventional forces have a more or less conventional role. But it's taken some years for this opinion to re-emerge.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Korean War. Were cadets from the COTC involved in the Korean War?
Yes, a number on graduation did serve. I can't be certain at this time how many, but I would think half a dozen or more.
Did you receive any feedback in this case?
One cadet, McLeod, came back and spoke of his experiences. There were others, but I didn't happen to become aware of them.
Was there confusion to some extent as to the, you know, the moral role of Canada in the Korean War?
No. Our involvement in the Korean War was comparatively uncomplicated. And there was no particular indecision about it that I recall.
It was under United Nations auspices.
It was under United Nations auspices, but it was seen as being more or less in the black and white context of World War II.
Interesting. How about the fighting in tropical countries or semi-tropical countries in a semi-guerrilla setting? I wonder if, as far as the Army goes, if Army team goes, if guerrilla warfare at all was taken into account.
Well, what theater are you referring to?
Korean.
Well, that wasn't tropical.
Well, semi-tropical.
I doubt. They had very bitter cold winters, you know, heavy snow. I think that was pretty conventional. And it wasn't guerrilla warfare, it was straight line warfare.
Yes, I wasn't saying conventional warfare entirely, but I think there were,
It was pretty well a conventional theater. Mind you, anything that I might say about it is derived, as any spectator might derive it from, you know, in the standard point of North America. I've never been to Korea. But there was fairly full information about the nature of the fighting. The North Koreans were very steadfast soldiers and gave maximum difficulty to the American forces, particularly, who were involved. But it was conventional warfare in that sense.
Relatively clearly defined fronts?
Yes.
In the post-war period, of course, like the Air Force played a tremendous part in the Second World War in assisting the Army in its strategy deployment. I wonder if the three services themselves are moving closer together as a fighting force. did you?
Well, arising out of the Second War, there was the concept of the task force, which was the ad hoc bringing together troops for a particular job, maybe Army, Air Force. I suppose the best evidence, early evidence of this type of thing, had to do with combined operations, which were really the brigading of elements as required for the objective. I don't think there was ever any difficulty in the task force concept. And so far as the services were concerned, there were no psychological barriers to working in a task force setting. But I've always distinguished in my own mind between task force concepts and the so-called unification of reporting services, which has been brought about in Canada since the last, either 10 years ago. I thought the unification idea was psychologically unsound. I still think so. And perhaps the best evidence of my conclusion in that connection is that we're the only people who have invented it. The nations which rely more heavily on their armed services than we do have never found it either necessary or desirable to enter into a unification program.
You know that back in the 20s, the federal government attempted a form of unification too. But kind of
well, I think it was cockeyed then too. See, the whole thing that holds the military fabric together is an induced psychology. And you can't thin that out effectively among three services and still have it work. I think it's pitiful to see naval officers wandering around in sea green uniforms when every other navy in the world is in navy blue. You know, it's an oddball thing that you ought not to be called upon to explain in a strange form. It's not so bad for the Army. The Army can get along in almost any kind of uniform. But I think the fact is we're getting away from unification since it's been introduced. Eventually, I think the three services will be restored. But that's not to say at certain levels of command there ought not to be unified command. That's a perfectly normal and logical thing. But the notion of turning out sailors and soldiers and airmen in a common mold is just a lot of baloney. It's just psychologically unsound.
Do you know what the political motives are behind the unification?
I'm really uncertain what the motives were. I think they had notions of economy and they had notions of national identity and a lot of trumped up notions. I was never persuaded. I told Hellier so on many occasions.
You had joint annual parades with the other two services.
Oh yes, these were on occasion, you know.
How did they work out?
No problem. No particular difficulty. You know, you put the three units together and they're afraid.
Was there any rivalry or competition between the services?
Oh, well, rivalry and competition, yes, I suppose so. Each arm would think himself the best of the lot, you know. That's normal, healthy.
One very important change in COTC, I don't have the exact date, government and the cadets. The government took a much more greater financial responsibility for the cadet university education, paying the tuition fees and monthly salary, and of course the summer camp. And I wondered how this would have affected the Corps recruiting, for example, and the type of cadets would have come in under these circumstances. There's also the compulsory military obligation after completing university.
Well, I think you're referring in part to the reserve officer training financing.
Yes.
That really postdates my involvement, and I don't have any experience with the concept. However, it was introduced at a time when generally the momentum toward the services was diminishing. It began in a period which I referred to a little while ago when there was maximum confusion about the role of the services. I think it was probably introduced as a means of inducing more interest, but I'm speculating when I make that suggestion.
Did you observe any problems of recruitment in your last couple of years at CEO?
No. Generally speaking, we have high interest, and we didn't accept everybody who applied. We had a regimental selection board in regular function, and I don't know what the rates of application and recruitment were as related to one another, but while I was there, we had a selection.
I noticed the Naval Training Division on campus seemed to have recruitment drives, and this is reported in the UBC, but not the COTC itself. So.
Well, we had drives, of course, and but we had a very healthy number of applicants, more than we could handle.
In 1948, you graduated and left campus to practice law. Did you at this time contemplate giving up the command?
Not at that time, no.
But it would have been less convenient for you, obviously, now, not being on campus.
Oh, no. Matter of fact, it really didn't make that much difference. I lived just a short distance from, as a matter of fact, I built a home on the University of Illinois in 1951, so I was very close to the campus at that time.
All the commanding officers, you are unique, actually, having come up through the POGP ranks. And then an officer in the Corps and then a commanding officer. And I wondered, do you think your outlook was different from some of the other commanding officers who had quite a different background, experience of World War I, for example, or some Colonel Letson was part of very, very much part of the Canada's military establishment?
No, I think so far as attitudes, focusing on the Corps were concerned, there would probably be a very high degree of consistency. The differences you can point to, but there are differences of age and differences of experience and point of time more than anything else. Once you're turned out in the Army, there's a pretty high degree of consistency and thought among those who survive the system.
When you were a student, though, and also commanding officer, mind you, you're one of the older students on campus. A lot of the cadets must have been your peers in age and status in a lot of ways, in education. I wonder if this has ever sort of recognized any problems in that way.
Well, there didn't seem to be. When I took over, I was 26, and I suppose the age of the cadets would be in the 19 to 22 range. So at that age, 3 or 4 years makes a little difference, and I'd had the advantage of service, so that it wasn't a question of one student talking to another from that standpoint.
Okay, what do you think is the most important contribution to the armed forces of university educated cadets?
Well, anyone who is in the armed forces with a university background, and I would think at this point all commissioned officers would be in that category, and has the undoubted advantage of a somewhat liberal background, somewhat broader viewpoint than might be available to someone who had not had a university education. University education is increasingly common, but I think there are undoubted advantages associated with it. And if you're going to be an officer, you need all the background that you can muster or acquire, beg, borrow, or steal to be effective in that role. It's not a technician's job. It's a job which ideally requires quite a breadth and a certain humanism, albeit couched in disciplined discharge, so that you're not really turned out as a technician, you're an officer. You have a certain technical capacity, but more than that, you're supposed to bring an example. You're supposed to bring some superiority of intellect, some superiority of vision for the job. I'll never forget my old platoon sergeant, the unit I took over in the Sea Force. We had taken up a tour of duty for 24 hours in a town in Militello in Sicily. And it was the first real job I had in the regiment. I was very keen to see it go well. We were the law in Militello, my platoon and I, for 24 hours, and so I had pickets out, and we were in occupied territory, of course, and so we were on the TV and all the rest, and I was pretty anxious to see it go well. And I was making quite a number of rounds to see that everybody was correctly disposed and behaving himself. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess it was, the platoon sergeant came to me. He said, "You might want to make a suggestion." But certainly, because I was getting a little tired at the point. He said, "Well, I've been watching you, and you've been going around and looking at everything and keeping your sharp eye out." He said, "I just wanted to tell you, sir, that's really not your job." He said, "All me and the boys want you to do is read the battle, and we'll do the rest." So I thought it was a rather valuable lesson. An officer is supposed to read the battle. And read the battle is an expression that was used in the Army, which really meant that you would size up a situation and see what was required, and issue orders to see that what was required was done. And so in this very kindly way, the sergeant, he was an old man, he was in his 30s, I was 22 at the time, he was telling me that really all the boys wanted me to do was to keep my eyes open and tell them how to stay on the tunnel. And that's really what the job of an officer is all about, to foresee difficulty, to analyze what's required, to issue orders, to contain or overcome the difficulty, and press on. That's really what it comes down to. So I got the best lesson in the whole Army in that, exchange with my sergeant in Sicily.
what do you think are the values of military training to a person? Not only in army life, but also in civilian life.
Well, I suppose the leaving aside the technical things that you have to learn, the chain of command and the organizational structure and so on, I suppose the chief thing you get from it is an immense amount of self-control. By the time you're turned out, certainly as a combat officer with battle school and everything behind you, you have been pushed to the limit physically and psychologically. In battle school, you go till you drop, and you're harassed by your guys, and they try to confuse you and try to lead you astray and try to get your goat and try to make you lose control of yourself. Those who do flex the torque. It's a policy, it's a program of calculated harassment, physical and mental. So that by the time you survive that, you know the limits of your own endurance, physically and psychologically, and that gives you an immense amount of self-confidence. Probably no other way of getting it.
A situation, for example, that you might ordinarily fear, you realize that you could cope with it.
That's right. And that's what the training is really intended to give them, a sense of your own capacity and a sense of how far you could go and still be in control. And the general result of all this is that the tougher the situation in which you find yourself, the calmer you force yourself to be to cope with it.
As a commanding officer, what values or experiences did you want the cadets to obtain from that training in the grade of COTC?
Well, the COTC training concerned itself with fundamental knowledge about the Army, fundamental knowledge of military law, fundamental knowledge of tactical concepts, fundamental knowledge about Army structure, fundamental knowledge about man-handling, man-management, in other words. I don't think in these interviews you want to reach the conclusion that a very high degree of proficiency was necessarily sought or attained. It was because of its limited exercise, it was a fundamental attainment in most cases. But out of it all, a man would have a sense of perspective about the service that he wouldn't previously have had. And he would have a basic knowledge on which to build in terms of his later service experience. So that unless he was a damn fool, he was reasonably well prepared as to information and as to psychology in terms of what might be expected of him later. And the training was nevertheless sufficiently detailed that he could weed out people whose prospects for success were obviously limited, and in respect of whom, both from their point of view and the Army's, there ought to be a separation.
Do you recall your feelings when you left the Corps in 1953?
Well, yes, I left under pretty obvious circumstances. I had been active in politics, then Attorney General, and it really wasn't practical. I had continued for about a year until succession had been arranged. But it wasn't practical to be an active politician and commanding officer of the unit at the same time. From many points of view, not the least of which was time, but more importantly, there was a duality of role, which has been considered.